You're listening to Career Chats with Phil Ray Smith, brought to you by Michael Page.
Hello and welcome to the Career Chats podcast, brought to you by recruitment experts Michael Page. This is the final episode in the second series of our podcast, where diversity and inclusion has been the focus, and in particular, we've been delving into the often complex topic of workplace inclusion. Today's guest is perhaps something a little different from what we've had on previous episodes, in that he's here to talk about data and economics. But not just any data and economics. Specifically, he's here to talk about the data and economics of happiness, and how measuring and understanding how to harness its power can transform your workforce into productive, creative, and indeed happy individuals. Welcome, Nick Marks.
Hi.
Now, Nick, we're going to be chatting very shortly, but just as a quick reminder, I have to do this advert every time. You can listen to Career Chats on the Michael Page website and on Audioboom, Spotify, and the Apple Podcasts app. To make sure you get the next episode as soon as it's available, subscribe to Career Chats by hitting the subscribe button in your player. And if this is your first time listening to us, why not go back and listen to some of our previous episodes? On this series, we've spoken to guests from work-life integration expert Zoe Sinclair and the inspirational Irene Apple, as well as the mental health campaigner Rob Stevenson and diversity champion Bianca Miller-Cole. All well worth a listen, if I do say so myself. Anyway, that done, back to today's episode, the subject of workplace happiness. And Nick, I guess it could be said that you've devoted your life and career to happiness. Is that right?
It has sort of turned out that way. You know, it's kind of a bit of a random walk, but I've ended up at happiness, which is not a bad place to end up.
Well, quite. And first and foremost, how important is it really to be happy?
Well, I mean, it's a debate that's gone back to ancient Greece, isn't it? Like, What is the purpose of life? And, you know, the life well lived, is it about happiness? Is it about pleasure? Is it about meaning? And I think people have always thought about that. And probably as we've sort of become richer as nations over the last couple of hundred years, and particularly recently, you know, our just survival has just been taken care of. And then I think it becomes like, what's life for? What's the purpose of life? And probably happiness is the way that we humans mainly think about it.
Wow, that's a deep opening one. A good answer, though. So, and then here's another one of these difficult questions, and I'm sorry, but, you know, how can we be more happy? Very open question for you there.
Well, I mean, how we can be more happy is really our choices about what we do with our lives. You know, we've all got, you know, 24 hours a day, and it's like, how do we use them, and how do we balance between things? And, you know, our relationships are obviously pretty critical to our happiness. I mean, we're very social creatures. But also what we do that expresses ourselves, that, you know, is creative, you know, these all come into it. And looking after ourselves, you know, it's for sure that, you know, our physical health, our fitness, these things all come into it. So it's a mixing pot. And I think a happy life tends to be a varied life. It tends to have different things in it, different activities. And, you know, the activities that you'd like to do are probably quite different than mine. They'll share some similarities, but there'll be some interesting differences. And that's what makes humans interesting. We're not all the same.
And this principle of happiness that, as you say, it kind of adds meaning and value to life, can it also be applied, and should it be applied into your working life?
Yeah, I mean, work is the second largest single activity we do in life. The first is sleep. The second is work. I don't know, what would you think the third is for?
Third, just family time.
It's actually screen time, depressingly. So, you know, TV, computer, you know, games and stuff like that. So if it's the second largest activity and the first is sleep anyway, so we're not awake, it would seem it's pretty critical to our happiness that we think about what we do at work. And, you know, there's all those old sayings, some of which are a little trite, but, you know, if you enjoy what you're doing, you never work a day, you know, it's that sort of stuff. But I think that's partly true. I mean, And people who enjoy their work, I think, are much less stressed in their overall lives. So sometimes there's a trade-off. Of course, we have to earn money. We have to, you know, create our way of living. But if you do work that you enjoy, you'll live a much better life.
Okay. So I'm really interested to kind of drill down into that. First of all, your working life, but also how happiness can be applied to people's working life. But I also wanted to talk about the Happy Planet Index, because you're thinking about happiness on a much broader scale as well, aren't you? Tell us a bit about what it is.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm a slightly grandiose creature, I think, on big scale. And I I worked on big quality of life indicators since the 90s. I'm a statistician by trade. So I come into happiness with thinking about how do you measure it. And I started off measuring quality of life and moved into well-being and happiness, you know, later in my career. But I was interested in how nations, you know, what do we think about what national progress is, and you know, and so I started thinking on that and eventually produced what was called the Happy Planet Index, which is actually a very simple indicator, and it's to take on GDP. It's to say that surely that you can't measure quality of life just by how much stuff we have and how much we consume. It's got to be about our experience of life, and the Happy Planet Index tries to capture that by saying that, you know, how do we measure good lives? And I would say it's yes, how long we live. You want to live a full life, but it's how happy you are. You want to live a good life. But then the Happy Planet Index, and the word planet is in there, is about actually sustainability. And it's saying how much of the Earth's resources do we use to get there? So it's sort of a bang per buck indicator. It's how much happiness and well-being do we get for our ecological resource use? And it came up with that idea. I didn't actually name it the Happy Planet Index. I named it Sustainable Wellbeing Index, and it wouldn't, no one would have read it at all.
Yeah, interesting.
And someone said, why don't we call it Happy Planet? I thought, yeah, that's better. And it went absolutely ballistic when it came out in 2006. And strangely, no one had thought about things like that before. I thought it was a very simple idea, and I do think simple ideas can cut through things. And, you know, it got into so much media around the world when it was released, because it rank ordered nations, and that's... statistically, that's very playful.
Oh, yes. Journalists love a good list.
They love a good list. And it's like, and we deliberately did that to get sustainability on the agenda. And so it became, it was, and it cuts through so much because it just says, you know, this country, good life expectancy, good happiness, low ecological footprint, great.
And a good example of that is Costa Rica, right?
It's
a real outlier. Because,
well, it's not actually an outlier. It's actually got a set of characteristics which describe a country that does well from people perspective and planet perspective. So Costa Rica is a medium development country. It is very family orientated. Latin America is very social. If we think of a Latin American, we think of someone vibrant. If we think of someone from Central Eastern Europe, you know, we tend to think of someone a little bit more lower energy. And that comes out in the data. Okay. Latin Americans are much more social. They're much more vibrant. They dance. They sing. They fight. You know, but they're very alive. And also, it's a small country, and it's got a lot of coastline, a lot of wilderness. We find that people are happier in green space. So just as a natural thing, people are happier in the countryside than in the cities. Small countries, a lot of wilderness, coastline, are happier than ones which are more urban. So there's a lot of characteristics there in Latin America. Yeah. They're very peaceful. If you think of Costa Rica and the area around it, you know, you've got Nicaragua, countries that have been in conflict. Costa Rica is very peaceful. It had no gold, so the Spanish weren't very interested in it. It was a trade route across Latin America, so it's always been protected by the US. So it's got a lot of characteristics that go for it that make it a very stable. Women's rights are very strong there. Literacy is very high. So they do a lot of things right there.
We should all be more like Costa Rica if we could.
Yeah.
And how much traction has that index, the Happy Planet Index, continued to have? Because I remember David Cameron was talking about happiness of the UK when he was Prime Minister for a while. But then, you know, stuff got in the way. You know, I won't mention Brexit, I just did. But, you know, how much currency can it have amongst our leaders and the way they shape their kind of policies?
So one of the things we campaigned for when I was at the New Economics Foundation was that the UK should have a national indicator of well-being, that we should, if we want to understand the well-being, the happiness of the population, we need to measure it. And actually Cameron, to give him credit, did put that in about 2011. And the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, is the only national statistics agency in the world that has a national indicator of well-being. So once you've got the data, you can start thinking about how would that affect policy. Now, when Cameron came into government, big society, well-being, these were big things he was pushing, but kind of they have ebbed away. But there are all sorts of well-being officers in, you know, local government, across government agencies, who do think about that broader concept of well-being, which is slightly broader than happiness. It gets into physical well-being. It gets into mental health. We are seeing a huge increase of interest in mental health, which, you know, has been shocking how bad we've been about mental health, you know, in the workplace, at home, you know, the spending on it is very, very low. So there are some bits of progress, and of course, not nearly enough for me.
And what is crucial, I suppose, in the way that you approach happiness is that you, I don't know if you measure it, I don't know if that's the right word, but you can put sort of, I've seen you put cold, hard figures against the impact of, say, happiness in the workforce.
Yeah, and I mean, happiness, people get worried if you measure it as if you're sort of missing the point by putting a number on it. But if I ask you a question like, you know, so, you know, how happy were you at work this week? So I've time-bound it, I've said this week.
Right.
You know, I say 1 to 5 from very unhappy to very happy. Well, you know, how happy were you at work this week?
My honest answer is it's been a pretty good week, actually.
So I'm going to say four to five.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you can put a number on it. And people can do. And if they've got a 1, 2, a bad week, they know about it. And if they're steadily just a 3 and okay, all I can say about that is that they're not doing their best work. You know, if you're just okay at work, you're getting along, but I don't suppose you're the most creative. I don't suppose you're in the best team you've ever been in, and you're having the best experience. And so okay after a while gets a little bit heavy. And so, you know, if you can be in a workplace where you've got many more good weeks than bad weeks, we're all going to have bad weeks. There's going to be stress. Something's going to happen. You're going to fall out with someone. A project's going to go wrong. IT is going to break. Whatever it is, you know, there are things going to happen. But how quickly do you bounce back from that? That's the sort of stuff that you can pick up. And I'm a big fan, like Happy Planet Index, of doing very simple numbers to open up spaces for people to talk about. Because ultimately, you know, the numbers aren't going to change anything. It's what people do with them.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your career, because you alluded to it earlier. How do you end up being an expert in happiness?
I think by random walking, and in a sense, daring to random walk. You know, I was a statistician by trade. I went to Cambridge to read maths. Hated maths, because when you get to university to do maths, you don't see a number. I didn't realize that. And it was all Greek letters, it's proof, it's abstract theory. And so I started to switch into applied statistics, and I discovered that I'm an applied statistician, and I kind of wanted to change the world, you know, make it a bit better. And my weapon of choice was going to be numbers. So I, statistician, I did systems thinking, and it's before big computing power. So it's very much, how do you define a problem? How do you try and create interesting solutions to problems that are going to create a benefit? However you measure that benefit. So that's what I started doing. However, the sort of left field thing that comes in is that my mother was a family therapist. And I kind of liked my mum. I kind of liked how she was in the world. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, I should train as a therapist. So in my 20s, I also trained as a therapist. And those parts of my life were quite separate for quite a while. I did a little bit of work as a therapist. I worked in one of the first ethical investment firms doing environmental research, because I was always interested in sustainability. And I just had these sort of bitty bits. And some was projects. So sometimes I was working for somebody, sometimes I was a consultant. And I sort of wandered a bit through. But then in about year 2000, I was doing actually a project on a dysfunctional team at the New Economics Foundation, this think tank. And I was trying to help them through a transition. And the director of NEF said, look, Nick, we think the word well-being is coming onto the political agenda. You talk about, you know, therapy, you talk about numbers. Maybe you should come and do some work with this. And that's how I got into it. You know, someone challenging me to do it. And something that started as a 1 or 2 day a week project just became my life.
And so one of the key things that we talk about in this podcast is adaptability.
Yeah.
Is that what you're... career demonstrates?
Yeah, I think it. I actually knew in my youth Charles Handy, the management thinker, who's, I guess he must be in his 80s now. Anyway, he was a friend of my uncle's, and I once had a conversation with him, and he said that he said men, because he was talking to me, he said, don't normally achieve much until their 40s. And so why don't you just try things and see what you like doing? Don't be too worried about, you know, I was anxious, I was ambitious, I wanted to do something, I wanted to sort of be something. And he just said, just try lots of things. And I actually took that advice very seriously and did do lots of things. And I think then you can find your way. And probably the big thing I have, which is unusual, is these soft people skills and the hard statistical skills. And in a world which is, I think, increasingly about data, but is still very people-led, that's quite an interesting combination.
Absolutely. But it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because as we are led to understand it, the workforce in general is going to be required to be more adaptable and flexible. There's no such thing as a job for life or a career for life anymore. So what do you think are the kind of personal skills or qualities that allow you to have a more flexible career or a career that has transitions in it?
I think curiosity and a love of learning. And actually, again, that's the way the business world is moving, and it's talking about more agile ways of working. There ways we test things, we see whether they've gone well, we adapt. And I think we should kind of take that with our lives, and actually, you know, try doing different things. And I think that probably the big thing about adaptability is relationships. Is that if you, yes, you want to be adaptable, but it's like, how do you work with other people in an adaptable way? And that is a lot about communication. So I think having good communication skills, not letting anything fester if you've got a relationship problem, actually start talking about them. Understand that actually letting light on something actually starts to heal it. So if anything's going wrong, deal with it. So I think all of those things are about adaptability. I guess I now do it so intuitively, I sort of forget almost how you do it. But when you see people not being adaptable, being brittle, they're very difficult to work with. And I think that, I think these people skills are massively important in the workplace, whatever type of job you do.
And to bring us a bit up to date, tell us about kind of your main thrust of activity career-wise now.
So I left New Economics Foundation. I did a TED talk on my previous work, a Happy Planet Index, about 2010. And you kind of realize that was a nice bookend to what I'd done with policy. And I thought, you know, I'm only in my early 40s, you know, perhaps I'll try something new. And so I decided to think about work. My father had been a business guy, run a manufacturing company. And, you know, so business was always in my blood. And I thought, well, I'll try that. And if I'd realized how hard it was to set up a business, I might not have done it.
Okay.
But I just started thinking that, you know, we spend a lot of time at work, you know, happiness at work. I've got these skills about measuring happiness. There's got to be something here. And just really started to create a business, which is sort of to take on staff surveys, which, you know, if you say to people, have you done a staff survey? You know, their sort of whole energy sinks as they think of a long, boring form that they've got to fill out.
So true.
Yeah, and then they press the send button and then they never hear anything about it at all. And I wanted to create something which was much more tactile, much more responsive, and much more energetic than that. And that's ultimately what we've now created, and we call it Friday.
And so tell me a bit more about that. Is that an employee happiness index? Happy colleague index.
Yeah, we basically create what we call a happiness KPI for a business. So it's to sit with their other KPI, the other key performance indicators, but it tells you how happy every team is every week. And as you know, as I said with that question I asked you earlier, our time duration is a week, because people work in week sprints just naturally, Monday to Friday. I mean, that's why we call Friday, because it's a working day. It's a happy day, but it ends the week. So our measurement is at the end of the week, you look back on the week and reflect. And that's a classic way of measuring an experience. So we create a happiness KPI for businesses, and we help team leaders understand how their team are doing every week. And again, it's built on that sort of idea that if you're going to be flexible, you've got to have a sort of, we call it a feedback loop. You've got to understand and learn. And we have a micro feedback loop for teams, like every week. How was last week? You know, what's gone well? Have you got anyone you want to thank in the team? Because you can create this thing called positivity resonance in a team by actually, you know, if I thank you for the work you've done, you feel good for being thanked. I feel good for thanking you. But then if we share that with the whole team, everyone sees that you've done something good. And so it just resonates around the group. And positive emotions are really critical for work, in the sense that, you know, when we're enthusiastic, we're curious, we're interested, we're supportive to our colleagues, everything goes well. Whereas if we're frightened, you know, we become brittle. If we're angry, you know, we're not going to cooperate. So having a lot of positive emotions in the workplace is very good for everybody.
And I love the fact that you can have data to base your activities or your policies on. And thanking people openly, I guess, is one policy, but how have employers gone about sort of implementing or using the data that you give them about the happiness of the team?
So we try and help. So a lot of HR departments have HR analytics now. If they're large organizations, they're looking at data on, you know, how people change jobs or whatever like that, or everything. So we give them data on how the teams are, and they can look for the systemic effects in a system, because every organization will have a culture, whether they name it, that have values, which they often name, but they're often really terrible at actually implementing. You know, I was with a CEO this week, and he said, oh yeah, we've got these values. And I asked him what he were, and he went, one, two, and then, oh, what was the third one? And this is the CEO,
right?
Yeah, you know. And so actually, how do you implement those things, and how do you get them? And I think you do that by doing something very regularly. That's why it's weekly. And you create easy to understand data. Basically, you're creating good, bad signals in the organization. Is this going well? Is it not? And just trying to capture that. So simplicity, I think, is very, very important. But then having the depth of data for analytics, you can actually start to understand the types of people that are flight risks, the types of people that are likely to be high achievers, and that sort of thing can come through the data too.
And you also talk about five key factors for happiness in the workplace, or in general, I suppose. But these ones are, I guess, are particularly appliant to the workplace.
Yeah, I'm very keen on lists of five.
Okay.
Five fruit and vegetables is already considered the healthy number. So five is a healthy
Must
number.
Must be true.
So, and it's about the right length of list, in that we can't remember lists of 10 when, you know, we don't remember them. So they are basically what we call the five ways to happiness at work. And they are connect. Relationships are really important. Be fair, because if you're not treated fairly, with respect, work-life balance respected, then you're just going to get angry. Empower. So, you know, it's actually delegating and helping people use their strengths. Challenge. We actually like to be challenged. There's this myth that we're happy doing nothing. We're not. Boredom is very corrosive. You know, actually being challenged and stretched is a great experience. And inspire. If what we do feels worthwhile, we feel we're accomplishing things, these are really good things for us. So those five things of connect, be fair, empower, challenge, inspire are the five ways. And they're kind of synergetic, in that you can't just do one and not do the others. You have to kind of do them all, and they feed off each other. And they're really clues for both HR and line managers about how to run happy organizations and happy teams. So, yeah.
And you often talk about, you know, happiness being common sense and good business sense too. Mm. So are you saying that you get those five things right and not only will the teams be happy, but, you know, the business will be abundantly profitable?
Abundantly profitable. It's clearly not the only factor that makes a business profitable.
Not.
But, you know, we know from our data that it's highly predictive, so that if a team drops half a point on that 5-point scale, they're going to have probably 17 to 20% higher staff turnover the next quarter. So it's very quick. People aren't happy. They can move quite quickly. We know that if they improve by half a point, they've got like 7, 8% extra productivity. Often difficult to measure productivity at team level. So that's a sort of general figure. We know that employees that are happy, even if they leave, they're going to become your brand ambassadors, is what they call it. But they're going to start talking about their business, say, yeah, that was a great place I worked. You should try that. So that helps with talent attraction. We even know, and I find this amazing, is that companies with good cultures have got higher share price growth. And so if you do well on Glassdoor or Great Places to Work, you can start categorizing those companies. And I wouldn't even say those are the best measures, but they are measures. And you see about extra 3% share price growth when you have good culture, which is kind of Warren Buffett style extra return. So it's quite considerable.
Oh, absolutely. And the effect of compound interest.
Yes.
Suddenly away.
Yeah.
So we love kind of news you can use on this podcast, advice that people can put into practice. So what advice would you give to employers and, you know, individual line managers on how to kind of, well, raise the morale and productivity, but ultimately raise the happiness of their workforce?
So my advice would be, dare to ask the question, because I think a lot of people avoid it. They worry they're going to open a Pandora's box. You know, if they start asking anything about emotions, you know, if you ask how you feel, what are you going to do? So I think it's about daring to have the conversations. It's about taking care of yourself, of course. You know, if you're a line manager and you're burnt out, you're going to find it very hard to have a happy team if you're unhappy. So there is about modeling it and leading it. I think that senior leaders often in organizations will go, oh yeah, we want staff to be happy, but I don't want to talk about the senior management team. We'll take all that stress because we're big and strong, and, you know. And actually looking after yourself is obviously the first step, because then that gives permission for other people too. Asking regularly. I mean, really, we've come intelligently to why we think it's about weekly, because, you know, I often say the church has Sunday, and they build rituals around that, and that's actually how the working week arrived. The Sabbath, you know, was to break the working week for rest, and then that's where religion sort of got its foothold, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
I'm not very religious myself, not that I have a problem with that. But what's very interesting about the dynamic of that is having a day a week to think about life beyond work. I think that's very, very healthy. So on a Friday, just reflecting how it's gone actually helps you transition to the weekend very well. You know, you can leave your work behind, because even if you've had a frustrating week, if you can mark it on a Friday, write down your frustration, then you can go to the weekend and think, we can pick that up on Monday as a team, whereas you just take it home by yourself. So I think it's about doing little things very often, listening to each other better, acting, getting rid of frustrations. You know, it's like if you've got a frustration at work, it can be an IT thing, it can be anything, and it's not dealt with, that just ebbs, eats away, you know. So it's dealing with a lot of little things on a timely way.
All right. So how do teams go about implementing strategies that are built up off the back of the happiness scores that you measure?
Yeah, so we, as I said earlier, we have sort of that very fast way of thinking at a team level, but there is also a slower, strategic, more considered way that organizations need to think, you know, which is looking at the overall pattern. So using the five ways, or using the data on how teams are happy or not, and thinking about how can they implement sort of organizational wide strategies. So that might be about how do they support line managers to have better conversations at a team level. And often line managers are kind of promoted for their technical skills and not their people skills, and they feel slightly out of their depth. And if they're not supported by the organization, that's actually unfair on them, you know. So how do you support a line manager to lead a great team? And so, you know, sometimes I run workshops, we call it managing for happiness, but it's how do they do that, and how do they set up that pattern? And then also an organization might look at, you know, perhaps they can see that creativity or learning is weak across certain sectors, certain parts of the organization. Well, how can they put in training or put in challenges to people to be more creative or learning? What are their learning budgets like? Do they give people autonomy over their learning budgets? Can they go and choose things which look slightly sort of horizontal rather than vertical about what they're doing? That, you know, but you know, a lot of organizations find that allowing people to volunteer, for example, can help them pick up new skills that are business ready, and it's not a traditional way of training people. And I think these more creative things are very, very good. So other examples might be, I mean, there's a shocking statistic that only 40% of people take their annual leave, full annual leave. Mm-hmm. And actually encouraging people to take their full annual leave will help them recover, help them have less burnout, and to leave work behind. You know, work's very 24/7 these days. Well, actually, you know, we know one organization where they paid a bonus if you didn't answer an email while you're on holiday. So actually helping you switch off. So there are things like that, that these organizational wide things can be act on quite strategically. But that's really helping senior leaders, HR, people directors to sit back and think about those big picture things.
As a manager or as a boss, and what about as an employee? Like, what advice would you give to someone who maybe is feeling, you know, the number three that you talked about on the scale, you know, work's okay. It's not that it's terrible, but week after week, I'm giving myself a three in terms of the happiness. And I don't really feel that this is kind of, it's not sparking joy, to talk about another person, to use a phrase from someone else who kind of talks about happiness. What would you do in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're very unhappy, you kind of know you've got to jump, and you do. You know, it's burning, it's on fire, and when you're really enthusiastic, you're on fire in the positive way. In the middle, there's sort of nothing going on, is there? And but think of those five ways of connect, be fair, empower, challenge, inspire. Which of those is not getting met? Because some of them won't be getting met as your sort of needs. And either try and find a way to do that in your job, in your role, or find a, you know, a horizontal career path. Is often difficult to just get a promotion, but you could find ways to move in the same organization if it's big enough, or jump ship. And actually, but next time, and when you go to change job, of course you want to take care of salary, but don't fall into the mistake that an extra 5,000 is going to make you happy. If you walk into a toxic environment, you're going to feel bad again. You'll feel much better taking a job that you like the people, that you can see where you can stretch and grow, that you can see that you're going to work with someone that's going to let you do your own work, and that you like what the business or the organization does. You know, if you find what they're doing interesting and inspiring, you'll be happier. And that will be much, much better for you than a few extra thousand. So be careful about chasing the money. Don't ignore it. It's important. But actually look at those other things much more.
Beautiful thoughts. Beautiful thoughts. I love it. So you seem to have got the whole happiness thing sorted. You seem a very happy person as well, if I may say. So when you look at your career and your life and your work, what is it that actually makes you happiest?
Well, I am a happy chap. I remember once meeting someone in an airport and him saying, "What do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I do stuff on happiness." He said, "Oh, well, you look like the right man for the job." And I do have a lot of what they would call a lot of positive affect. I smile a lot. I am very warm. Actually, you just have to watch out. Sometimes that can get you in trouble and you override negativity and you don't listen to some negative signals that are going on. So if I've made mistakes in my career, I've been too optimistic on occasions. And in a sense, you know, seeing good in things when actually I should have been noticing about what wasn't going right.
Interesting. So too much happiness or, you know, just...
Yeah, you have to watch out for everyone has a little dysfunction in them and I do as well. And I think that what I'm happiest at is I have different things I'm happy at. I mean, I still can get very lost in an Excel spreadsheet and really enjoy myself. I mean, I am a statistician and, you know, and occasionally I get drawn back into the data and I love it. I love coming up with new ideas and ways of thinking about it. And the great thing about creating a product is that your customers give you feedback. And if you listen to them, they've often got a good point you haven't thought about and you have to think about it in a different way about how you implement it. So I like all that. I really don't like, you know, all the sort of finance stuff and it's not my strength, you know, and I'm often the more big picture than I am detail. I can get into detail with the stats, but I can, so I do have to work like everyone else with other people who's compliment you. You know, just got a new colleague. She's fantastic. And she's just so good at starting and finishing things. I'm really good in the middle. But I never quite know when I finish something because my mind works quite quickly. And I think about the next part. And she's really good at going, right, that's great. We've got that. That's there. Now you can think about the next thing. So I sometimes need a little bit of grounding. But I'm happiest when I'm in that. I mean, I'm a public speaker and I really like that. And the reason I like that is I love challenging an audience and really getting to think about it, because I don't think as a society we think enough about our experience of life, and we can call that happiness and we can call it experience of life, and happiness is sometimes a bit way out there for some people, but if we think about having great experiences, I think we should reflect on that more. And we get so caught up in the pace of life, and this is not to blame people, it's like life is so quick and we've got our mortgages and our children and our, you know, and the commute and this and that and that. But I think taking time out to reflect and think about whether you're happy can have a profound effect on your life. I mean, I left a marriage for that reason. You know, I really realized that although I loved my kids, I loved being married, as in the idea of it, I was actually deeply unhappy in that relationship. And I had to really dig down to get the energy to move out of that relationship. But it's actually one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And, you know, I'm still on decent terms with my ex and my kids are growing up fine. But it took a lot of energy to do that. But I had to recognize, first of all, that I was unhappy. And so unhappiness is a signal to change. And so reflecting is very, very good. And I love helping people with that. I love challenging them and trying to bring that out. Because one, people are interesting, and one, life, goodness me, we've got a life. Let's enjoy it.
Thank you for that answer. I love that answer. And listening to it, it kind of really resonated, the self-awareness you have about yourself. It was a very authentic answer. And, you know, you said, "I'm not perfect. I'm good at this, but I'm less good at that." And that's really been a pattern of all the people that we've spoken to in this season, you know, which is really perfect considering that diversity and inclusion has been our theme. You know, there's been a lot of people talking about self-awareness, whether it be about their mental health or their happiness. A lot of people have been talking about how they are not a rounded and perfect individual, that they are different. And that's okay in that we are different. And if you're aware of that, that's where you can build and be happy.
I just so agree with that. And I think that as one becomes older, you know, I think one accepts one's imperfections more, you know, and that you don't have to, you know, and anyways, if you know someone that's kind of perfect, they're almost untouchable, aren't they? It's like, you know, I mean, Leonard Cohen, who's one of my favorite musical writers, used to say that there's a crack in everything, it lets the light in. And I think our cracks are actually what makes us beautiful. And that doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't deal with our annoying habits or things like that. I mean, my wife would, my new wife would say that, you know, I could still maybe do some things better. Yeah. But, you know, but it's like, you know, we both love and accept our weaknesses, and you have to be vulnerable in a relationship and do those. And I think in life, when you accept your vulnerability, then actually that's when you're strong, sort of paradoxically.
And not to be too glib about it, but those differences, when they come together, can create strength that's more than the sum of the two parts, potentially.
Oh, I mean, like, yes, in a relationship, I have a fantastic relationship. But in teams, it's like when you get a team that really gels. I had it once before when we were doing Happy Planet. We had 6-7 of us. I mean, we used to rather modestly call ourselves the dream team, but you know, but we, and they were such bright, and they were sort of 10 years younger than me. And, you know, and we really, really worked well together. And it was what we called team flow. We used to call it. We bounce ideas around, and we had different personalities. We had me, I was very, very quick. I worked with a guy called Sam, Dr. Sam Thompson, and he was more reflective, and you needed to ask Sam the next day what he thought about our meeting yesterday, because he'd have another idea the next day, which was brilliant. But for him, it came a little bit slower. So taking care of different people in that environment, when you get a team flow really working, whether you accept each other's differences, you can argue. I mean, you can argue. You can even fall out, but you so like each other, you want to make up very quickly, move on, you know. But that is a great experience, yeah.
And for people who are listening who want to kind of just get hold of those five key factors for happiness, or just learn a bit more about your work, how should they do that?
Yeah, so my business is called Friday. Our website is called dofriday.com. Friday.com was a little expensive, so we got dofriday.com. Yeah. And I also have a personal website, which is nickmarks.org. Nick is spelled without a K, so it's N-I-C, Marks. And that's for my sort of speaking and my own thoughts.
Okay. Well, thank you, Nick, for a great discussion. It certainly made me happy.
Good.
This has been the final episode of this current series. That kind of makes me sad. But never fear, we're going to take a short break and we will be back. In the meantime, why not go and listen to some of the episodes in our ever-expanding archive? We've got career chats from everyone, including the polar explorer, Serena Fiennes, cricketer Matthew Hoggard, Joseph Valente, who won The Apprentice, and Bake Off star Ruby Bogle. To make sure you get the next season of podcasts as soon as they're available, why not subscribe to the Career Chats podcast by hitting the subscribe button in your player? And one final favour, if you've liked what you've heard so far, as we always say, why not give us a 5-star rating on the Apple Podcasts app? It really does help us in spreading the word. Well, thanks again for listening. Thank you again, Nick. And it's goodbye from me.